You're listening to Second Stories, created and produced by Second Story with me, Abigail Brocker, as your host. Second Story is a nonprofit based in Northern Virginia, working to provide safe havens and opportunities to grow and thrive to youth in crisis and their families. We help homeless youth and youth in crisis step away from their first story, one often marked by abuse, hardship, and crisis, and write their own second story, full of hope and promise.
I came home from elementary school, fifth grade, and there was all this furniture on the lawn. And my mother is just in this manic stage of kind of throwing things in a car. But ultimately, she was very clear that I wasn't going with her wherever she was going. And that was really, truthfully, one of the last times I saw my mother in person in the state of Virginia.
Many of us are familiar with the up and down typical narrative of foster care. Child is taken or released from birth family. Child enters the system. Child is matched with family. Child is adopted by family. We sometimes hear of the hardships that fill in these middle sections, but in the end, the narrative most often finishes with family and child being one, family and child being happy. We see posts on Facebook reviewing the many days children spent in foster care before being adopted. We watch movies like Instant Family, but those of us with intimate experiences with foster care know that the situation is much, much messier than these snippets often reveal. We don't hear as often about the youth whose foster care story is cut short. The ones who enter into foster care as preteens or teenagers. The ones who never end up with an adoptive family. Caitlin was one of those young people, a young woman who grew up without the family structure a lot of us take for granted. Yet if you knew her today, you would probably never guess. She's a mom, a wife, a friend, an entrepreneur, a success in all the standard ways. And Caitlin is not one to wallow. She was not one to focus on what she didn't have, but rather what she did. Ingenuity, independence, and outright intelligence. Her story sheds light on an important group, teenagers in foster care and otherwise disconnected youth. And she introduces us to all that these young people have many times endured and all that they have to offer us. Caitlin, I'm excited to talk to you. Thanks so much for talking to me and being open to sharing your story. It's always such a delight for me to reconnect with people who were introduced to us by receiving support as young people and then rediscovering us as adults.
Absolutely. I'm so excited to be here and to be able to share.
Thank you. Can you tell us more about your childhood?
I was born in Jacksonville, Florida. My mother was 34, I believe, at the time. And she and my father actually didn't know each other all that well. It was kind of like an accidental pregnancy situation in her mid-30s. And she decided to go ahead and just, you know, do it. If not now, then when? I feel like was kind of her attitude around it. But she and my father were married when I think she was maybe 6 or 7 months pregnant and formally divorced by the time I was 9 months old.
Wow.
So she had left Florida. I think I was a little bit under 2 years old by the time she had left Florida, which of course is where I was born, but then their divorce was final. So she came up to Northern Virginia, which was a place that she herself had spent some of her teenage and early 20s in this area and gotten one of her first professional jobs up here. So she had known of the area before, and Florida was where her parents lived. So that's kind of the connection there. But she moved back up here. And this is where I really kind of grew up, you know, made the lifelong friends and mm-hmm. spent a lot of my time developing roots. But ultimately, my mother had always struggled with mental illness, and she did a pretty good job trying as best as she was capable of to kind of tend to that and get the help that she needed. And most of the time she was pretty successful, and it kind of all came to an end, or kind of went down a downward spiral that really, really changed things for me around age 10. Her mother passed away, and she and her mother were extremely close, and that was kind of just this weird straw that broke the camel's back in a sense. And so that was kind of the beginning of the end. And that story is about a 3-year period of time. So between age 10, which was fifth grade, all the way up until 13, the summer before high school was kind of the deterioration and separation of our relationship and our dynamics and the familial bonds and all of that just forever changed. So with her mother passing, she entered a very, very, very deep depression, which ultimately resulted in her no longer leaving the house, getting evicted from the property we were renting at the time in Vienna. She had lost her job. And this was all over a period of, I think, like 3 months. I mean, it wasn't like one day, but it certainly wasn't super long period of time either. So it did feel very quick as a child. I remember that, but it was the eviction actually, where I came home from elementary school, fifth grade, and there was all this furniture on the lawn. And I don't know why I remember it, but there was like an elliptical machine, like it's some weird exercise machine on this lawn. And it's like the weird image that's burned into my mind of this. And that was really truthfully one of the last times I saw my mother in person in the state of Virginia. Wow. So we're getting evicted. I come home, all of our stuff is on the lawn, and she is just in this manic stage of kind of throwing things in a car. I think there might've been like a U-Haul. I can't remember. But ultimately she was very clear that I wasn't going with her wherever she was going. And so I ended up actually walking over to the neighbor's house, also a single mother, but had children of her own whom I had gone to elementary school with and was in school with at the time. And so we were friendly, but it certainly wasn't like, you know, she wasn't my aunt. She wasn't a family member. We weren't close to that extent or degree. And so when I had gone to the next door neighbors, she had kindly, just what a sweet, loving woman. Her name was Mary Sennett. I'll never forget her. She took me in with her five children as a single mother working full time. And she kept me for almost 6 months. My mother left. Nobody knew where she went. She no longer answered phone calls. She just quite literally drove off the face of the earth, in my perspective. So this poor woman, who again, not very close with my mother, certainly wasn't best friends with her, nothing like that. After 6 months, could no longer locate my mother. We were running into legal problems with school and like signing for papers and stuff like that. And I have no guardian. And my father was never, ever, ever in the picture after like the birth and the divorce. He was not a factor. So it's not that he was oddly in the background. He literally wasn't a part of this equation. So then ultimately this poor woman, after 6 months and being in the worst position ever that I could imagine, literally drives me to what at the time was alternative house and drops me off at this teen crisis shelter and says she has no idea what else to do with me. So at that point, that was kind of the beginning of a much more formal court process and an intake process in which, in this instance, I think it was Fairfax County Child Protective Services had come in and started the entire process of being deemed a neglect and abandonment case by the courts. And then ultimately that leads to foster care, the formalization of the foster care process for somebody in placement. So that entire process took place while I was basically living in alternative house at the time, which has always been, I believe, just that 2 week timeline in terms of like a career shelter.
I know. I've heard stories from the super early days that there were kids who stayed there for a long time. And now it's like a 2 to 3 week thing, but it is fairly common for us to have young people stay with us who are in that transitional season with CPS. I'm glad that there was a place for you in the midst of that.
I did continue to come back a number of times throughout high school in between placements or families or what have you for a couple weeks here and there. So I had been maybe like three more times after that throughout high school. And then in undergrad, I think, and right before grad school, I actually came back and volunteered with them also on the flip side. And so I remember very vividly the first set of counselors when I spent the months, like the 3-4 months in there, man, they were just, they were incredible. They were honest. They were kind. They were empathetic. They were transparent. I have such a soft spot in my heart for those people. I would love to figure out who they were and where they ended up in the end, what they're doing today. They were awesome.
What was going through your head as a 10-year-old watching your mom load up the car and then having it dawn on you that she's saying you aren't going in the car? Do you remember how that felt?
I do. And it's probably going to be an unpopular response. I was excited. I was like 10, right? Yeah. 10, 11. I was like, yeah, I have my mom. Like, cool. Bye. Right. You know, like I don't even think you have really the capacity to perceive and interpret that level of information. Like you have no idea what that means. Right. Truly. I mean, it's not that I wasn't processing it. It was like, I didn't even know what I didn't know. Our dynamic and relationship was very much peer type. I wouldn't even say like sistery, because she would have moments of wanting to be an authoritarian figure, but I could never give her that because she hadn't earned it ever. And we were very much equals in a lot of the things that we did, the things she talked to me about, the struggles. And so she had kind of shot herself in the foot with that dynamic all the way up until the unfolding of it all. And at which point truly felt fine with her leaving. And even the possibility, once I realized that this may not be temporary and this might be how it just is, of feeling like, well, like that was pretty awful. So like, it can only go up from here, right? I had no clue.
It doesn't sound like you guys had this super nurturing relationship. It sounds like things have been bad for a while.
They had been. Yeah. The dynamic was always hard. It was just me and her. She actually didn't tell me this until I was like 20 or 21, but she never even graduated high school.
Wow.
So she had no formal education. She had lied her way into every single job on her resume and just pretended that she had gone to formal school and nobody ever checked. She was extremely well-spoken, articulate, very fun to be around. She was charismatic. Mm-hmm. People loved her. When she was good, she was good. And I mean that in an external kind of like societal facing way. As a mother, there was so much healing, generational trauma, lack of self-actualization going on with her that she could not give what she never had. And she was even coming from a wounded space of not even realizing that she didn't have these things and could attain them if she just made that her mission.
When do you think it hit you that she wasn't coming back into your life?
Oh, probably by 16, I was pretty solid. And I was like, this is just going to be what it's going to be.
Wow, but it took 6 years.
It did. A little over three in formally living in other people's houses.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, tell us about that foster care process and situation.
Sure. The first family I ever went to, this is also a fun story I like to tell people, because I think the general public is not very aware that most often, at least 15 plus years ago, this was the case. I don't know if it's a different landscape now, but generally there are young or even middle-aged parents that come into foster care wanting to foster as almost a type of workaround to the lengthy and costly adoption process for babies. So they are frequently in there looking for younger children, babies preferably. And so to be an older child in foster care was very challenging. There's just this very screwed up perception that like, those kids are definitely screwed up, right? Like those are the ones that you can't help and are going to burn your house down and whatever. I did often feel like an outsider for a number of reasons, being older, knowing that they were in it for the baby, most likely, knowing that I was of an age at any point during this journey, I was of an age to be very aware and confident in who I was and where I came from. So I never gave off that kind of adopt me vibe. And I didn't want to be quite honest. I just wanted to get out. The foster families were all kind. I never, ever, ever had one that was even borderline abusive by any stretch of the imagination. I think I had 6 when it was all said and done, total families, before at 18. And I think this probably is still the case, but technically you can be a ward of the state in Virginia until 21. You don't automatically age out at 18. You have to actually petition the court and then prove to them that you are capable of taking care of yourself before they will cut you loose. So I did do that. March 12th, 2005, less than 30 days after that, I moved out of my last foster care house, and it was maybe like 12 weeks, 10 to 12 weeks before I graduated high school. That year. So I moved out. The only place I could afford was way out in Culpeper. And I drove every day back to school in Fairfax for a while. I ultimately switched to a school in Warrenton in Fauquier County and graduated there after knowing nobody. I walked across the stage less than 6 weeks after having transferred and graduating from there and didn't know a single soul in my graduating class. But I was so excited to kind of own my own future and really be the one responsible for making decisions. So I was unbelievably excited to get that opportunity. And I took it and I ran. Never looked back, got into every college I applied to. The hang up with that was actually the financing of it. So I ended up going to George Mason for undergrad, graduating there, and then went to do my master's down in Miami and got a master's in conflict analysis and resolution.
So interesting.
So that was another kind of thing that had manifested itself over my journey through all of this, was that school was not only the great constant, no matter where I was and what family I was with and all of that. So I got really good at the academic part of things, but also that it was the great equalizer. So that was always something that my mother had preached most of my life, that it didn't matter where you came from. Like, everyone's going to get in based on their grades and their SAT scores and whatever. Minus this whole, you know, pay your way in, hustle college scam that happened before which I always knew was a 10% of things, right? Like, for sure, that's how the world works. But I really, really hung on to education as kind of being like, you can go get it. No one but you can do that. No one can take it from you. It's all on you. It's all up to you and it's all on you. And so that really resonated with me. And I took that as far as I really could. And again, my mom didn't even share with me until I was in my early 20s that she had never graduated high school.
Yeah.
And she told me that she had purposefully never said that to me because she never ever wanted that to be an option for me. And I've thought about that a million times for some reason in my adulthood and often wondered if that would have changed anything for me. And I don't, I don't think it would have personally, but it's an interesting thought. And I look at my son and sometimes think, are there things that I did or didn't do that I won't tell him about, you know, purposefully with that same perception and thought process.
It sounds so unusual for a young person to not want to be part of a family. But then I think, you know, it sounds like you did a fair amount of things, almost as a little bit of an act of rebellion, but very responsible rebellion. Do you think part of not wanting to be part of a family unit was an act of rebellion? And if so, what got you to rebel so responsibly and to not rebel in other dangerous ways?
Sure. I don't know if it was an act of rebellion. I think it was formed by a couple of things. One, I've always had this weird, super intense independency in me, even as a child. Like, I never really felt like I needed to belong to somebody or hide under a tree or be protected. Nothing like that. I just never felt like that. And I think probably because it was never an option, as she was certainly not that for me. She was never a safe harbor.
You had to do that.
Right. It was either you figure it out or we're going to get evicted together. So maybe that played into it. But then the other part of it is, by the time I again had kind of formally been into the foster care process, I was very aware that I was not part of these families. There was always this weird element that existed in every house that you could feel in the air where I was not one of you. I did not have your same last name. There were always legal papers and stupid small stuff at a school that they couldn't sign that we had to call and wait for the social worker to come over and do. There were all of these things that consistently reinforced that we are not the same. And I was never treated the same, quite frankly, as their children. And not in a negative or positive way, but there are boundaries. There are just things that they can and can't do. This really isn't your child. This is an older child. All of these pieces, components are at play that you don't even really realize daily that kind of, again, reinforce that separateness. So I always was very, very, very aware that I was not part of this family and that most of them had no intention of, again, you know, truly adopting me. I didn't get that vibe. I wasn't looking for it. But I absolutely wanted that. And there's still a part like in deep down in me, but I wanted that for me and for her as a child. I wanted all of that to have happened as a kid, to really have been my foundation and formed me, to have wanted and experienced that safe space and that haven and that safety net that I've never in my entire life had. And, you know, has certainly served me to some degree, or at least I've forced it to serve me to some degree moving forward as an adult. But I don't know that it was an act of rebellion. It was just kind of, it was always that way. I was very aware that there were great families and that people had very different childhoods than I did. And one of the things I loved the most about their experience and that I deeply had coveted and wanted for myself was traditions. My mom didn't do anything in terms of traditions, like around holidays or what have you. And they always did. That was the weird kind of one thing where I'm like, man, I would love to be a part of like a family and be a part of a tradition. But anytime a foster family attempted to kind of inculcate me into their family traditions or whatever, it still very much felt not natural and disjointed and separate.
Yeah, I understand that. Do you think that other than your personal desire that your family had never broken down and that your mom would have been a responsible, good parent, considering the foster care situation felt so unnatural for you, do you feel like there would have been a better way, or are you more just resigned there wasn't a better alternative and it just sucked? Or have you thought about that at all?
Oh, good question. I don't know that it could have been better done. I think there's so many ways that you can dive into that one. And I think a lot of it does have to do with the system. I think my social worker was like 24 most of the time. When I was 24, you got to be kidding me. Like, and I'm making choices about people's lives, like really like deep stuff as a social worker, and they're overworked and overburdened and there's no resources and there's no money. And there's, I mean, it's awful. It's horrific. These people are set up to fail. There is no winning here. So I don't know that anybody had an option and didn't take it and could have better showed up or could have better been a part of this in process. And again, every foster family I had, it's probably the best well-intentioned people on the planet. I couldn't have asked for people that were in it in a more loving way and really did try very, 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 very hard to make the best of it. But there's just this element that exists where I am not one of your children. We don't have that foundation and safety. I haven't experienced your safety net ever. And this is temporary. And they don't make the decisions, quite frankly. Like, they aren't in a position of power either. Neither of us are. Mm-hmm. Not the child and not the family. They're dictated to just as I am in terms of a social worker just showing up one day at 4 p.m. and throwing you a couple of trash bags and saying, we're moving to the next house, which is frequent. So I don't think that anybody, again, you know, had the opportunity and didn't take it. And there's a lot that could be done better. I don't know where to even begin on that, though, to be quite frank. It's just so deep in every direction.
Yeah. So you touched on this, that you were able to be emancipated and continue high school. You know, this is something that we see all the time at Second Story with kids, that they just can't afford to live on their own and be in high school. It's incredibly rare to be able to do that. Tell us more about how that went for you. And I guess one of the things I wonder is, why do you think that worked so well for you? Do you think it was just the discipline and the drive, or if there were other factors?
I think the number one drive and factor in that working to my benefit and me being able to keep it together and be disciplined enough. And I worked full time all through undergrad, 40 plus hours a week. I went to school full time and graduated in under 4 years for undergrad, did the exact same thing through grad school. So I always worked full time, usually more than one job, in order to make ends meet. So nothing about this was gifted or easy. But I will say that has always been my experience. So even as a kid, we were very, very poor. And then by the time where I was like in high school and had some sort of control over money, where at least I could go get like a part-time job with a little worker's permit, which I did do when I was, I think we were 14 or 15 when that happened, freshman in high school. And I had always had to pay for absolutely everything that I had, especially being in foster care. If I didn't go out and find the money, make the money, work it, figure it out, have 2 hours of sleep, make it work, figure out the credit, figure out the lenders, figure out your score, all of that, no one was ever going to do it for me. And my circumstances were never going to change. So I lived in that, I grew up in that, and I built that. So by the time I was 18, they just took off the blinders and the limitations to it. I could now go full force and control all of it and put myself in a house. And like, I'm not answering to anybody anymore. And now I can work 100 hours if I need to. But that was such a gift in the long run, never having been gifted these things and never having experienced that and even thinking that was an option, which a lot of people that grow up in very loving families do have, and have had that experience and have had things gifted to them and do have a safety net. You know, if you don't make a car payment, you can call mom and dad. Nope. On the 121st day, guess who repos? Honda does. So, you know, like, I'm now out of a car and now I have a repossession on my credit, which is 7 to 10 years later. So paying for it, like, this is real life. So I truly had to figure it out, and it wasn't pretty along the way, but I had no other option, truly.
Yeah, that's just incredibly, it's incredibly rare. I mean, a lot of kids end up homeless or sleeping in their car. It's very impressive. I'm sure that you have been told that and that you know that, but it's impressive that you were able to figure it out. And maybe part of that is moving through the system, and you probably picked up on things and paid attention to things that other kids who didn't have that experience would have never had the opportunity to have seen. Tell us more about where you're at now and what you're doing, how some of these experiences have impacted you.
Oh, sure. I'm still in Northern Virginia. I am in the Burke Fairfax area. I have a little boy and am married. I presently, in terms of work, own my own consulting business. I do human capital, generally talent acquisition type of work. So recruiting for very odd, different government contracts, usually highly cleared government contracts, for everything from Department of Homeland Security to the CIA to Health and Human Services or Department of Commerce, anything in between. Absolutely nothing to do with my degrees, but is very lucrative. And this is a money game. So
it's very interesting.
actually, it was the government shutdown of like a year and a half, 2 years ago now, that kind of catapulted me into being a consultant and striking out on my own and doing my own business development and all of that good stuff. And in terms of how all of this has affected me, it absolutely is. I would like to say that, you know, it's been an evolution. It is absolutely, and it still is, this experience of growing and continuing to grow up, even as adults that are in your 20s and 30s and 40s, we still have all sorts of cycles of evolution left in our own self-actualization journey. So this experience of being a mother, of being a wife, of just being a human adult by myself, all of these experiences give me ample opportunity to continue to show up and grow or not. Yeah. And the problems will keep just showing up until I choose to face them and grow because of it. And again, all of this kind of comes to you later on in life through your own life experiences and your own evolutions and your own self-actualization journey, especially having a child. Once that comes along, realizing that in order not to continue this dynamic or this path or this handing down of generational trauma over and over and over again, unhealed and unlooked at, you have to do all of this ridiculously hard work internally in order to go there and deal with it. And, you know, I had shared with many girlfriends over the years that there are pockets in time where I experienced these huge waves of issues I didn't even know were under the surface that are arising, that are triggered by certain events or, you know, like having my son or certain challenges in life as we grow older. You know, I didn't even know I would need her then, or I would want to lean on her then, or these traumas would surface in this way at this time. I thought I had dealt with it. It's like they just keep evolving and changing as time goes on and new opportunities give them a chance to pop up and kind of really, if you look at it in a positive light, give you the opportunity to finally work on whatever that is, right? Whatever the issue is, the challenges, the feelings, whatever. But I was sharing with a girlfriend last week that my son is probably one of the biggest evolutionary factors in this journey and in my relationship with my biological mother to date, in that I haven't spoken to her in 3.5 years after I was 18 and kind of went off on my own and went to undergrad and grad school and all that, and moved again from here to Florida and back and forth and wherever. We had always had on again, off again relationship, my biological mother and myself. And there were years where it was great. And then there were years where it was not, and we wouldn't talk for a few years. And her cycle still very much continues with the mental illness and depression. And in fact, I think presently she's in and out of residential institutions most often. Mm-hmm. So she's still very much struggling. She never truly recovered. There was never any sort of bounce back from that time when I was 10. It has stayed. Mm-hmm. This is just how it is now. Wow. She has never worked since then. Wow. She has always been on some sort of disability, some sort of mental illness, taking 500 separate pills for everything for the last 15 plus years. Wow. So our dynamic in our relationship has struggled and been challenged as I grow up and as I experience new things and come across new challenges in which it allows me to perceive our relationship differently or even look back and judge it differently or be more or less empathetic to her. When I had my son was a perfect example of that. When he was born, I never, ever, ever forget thinking, my biological mother always said to me as I was growing up, you know, just wait till you have a kid, right? Like you'll see, you'll see, you'll see. And it was always very much this thing of like, well, you don't know because you aren't a mother. Mm-hmm. And I always wondered, like, is that true? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, is she right though? Mm-hmm. Because inside of me inherently, I always felt like that's not the case. I don't believe that. But of course I wasn't a mother and I'm a child. And what do I know? Yeah. And then becoming a mother on the flip side of that, one experience I have had is that it is absolutely affirmed what I thought innately and intrinsically to be true in my core, which is that all of this is a choice. Every single part of this life, marriage, motherhood, adulting, it's all a choice. So something she had always said to me was that basically in my perspective, her decision to allow me to be formally put into foster care and not get her act together is what changed everything for us. And she is emphatic that there was no decision there. It was just what had to be done. And she had no choice, that mental illness just took over and there was no alternative. I strongly disagreed with that. And of course she would consistently say like, you don't have a kid, like you don't know, blah, blah, blah. But again, having my son just nothing more than reinforced the fact that this is a choice. Yeah. And it is by far the hardest thing I have ever had to do is raise this child for a number of reasons. One being that I have no other family. I was an only child and she was my only family and she's not here either. Right.
You didn't have anything modeled for you.
Correct. Yep. No model, but there's an infant that cries every 2 hours for 6.5 months. I haven't slept in 6.5 months. Yeah. Like, people have parents and family to help them with this. Right. We have nothing. Right. So it's just like, man. And there have been many days where I've cried and been like, when does this get easy? Yeah. When is it not a super challenge for me? Yeah. Is that ever a thing? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I say all that to say, when he was born, I actually stopped talking to her when I was pregnant, but that was kind of the end of it. And she has not resurfaced since then. But my choice to continue to not engage her. And I do have, I think, an email for her. Like, I have a way to connect with her if I could. And I have thought about it. There are certainly days and times and seasons in my life that are extremely challenging. I'm like, man, I would love to call my mom.
Right.
I'd love to call my mom and like ask about whatever.
Right.
And then I immediately realize how selfish that is, and that it would be an opening of Pandora's box, and that what I'm really seeking and looking for and desiring is the mother that I still wish she had been and will never be, and that I am trying to come into and don't know how to be. And so there's a lot of stuff that comes up later kind of in your life, even if you don't choose to have children, just as an adult, like you're just going through things and seasons of life happen. And it's like, oh, wow. Like, I really wish I could lean on her at that point. And you can't, or you shouldn't, truly, if you know that, again, it's just this downhill cycle with her. If I choose to engage it, this is not going to go somewhere drastically new. Like, this is going to be on repeat. So what am I doing? And so that's when I was like, and I'm done.
Yeah. Choices are such a paradigm, it sounds like, for your life. This choice really early on, I feel like you realize life is just a series of choices. And I wonder if that almost answers my question of why were you able to do so well when so many young people really, really struggle? And I feel like part of it is that you realize at a very young age that life is a series of choices, and it opened you up to make choices that maybe some young people don't even realize they have, like moving away to a more affordable place to live and switching high schools or something like that. You had this thing that maybe in a really weird kind of twisted way, your mom gave you a gift in that, and realizing you weren't going to feel helpless like she claims that she did, but you were going to take ownership of those choices.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's a beautiful observation and synthesis of information here. I think that's absolutely true. I never experienced anyone else changing my circumstance for me, ever. It was, if you hate it, go do something about it. You can sit here for as long as you like. Nobody's coming to drop off a pile of money. I ended up in a sorority in undergrad, which are still actually my closest friends to this day. And I would hold workshops twice a year, teaching them how to finance their way through college in the end, because I had done it for four times.
I mean, that's one of the primary things that we feel the need to teach young people is this is how to be self-sufficient. It is a real shame, and it's not fair to you or to anyone else to not have a support system. We would love for everyone to have a family support system, but since you don't, and since you have us for a time, let us do everything we can to make it so that you can fend for yourself, because that's the best tool in your toolkit that we can give you, is to make sure you understand how to budget, how to save money, what it looks like to hold down a job and to interview. And that's the real important stuff. It's not just making sure that you have a support system all the time, because unfortunately, we live in a world where that comes and goes. Mm-hmm. It's making sure that you can be self-sufficient.
Absolutely.
Which you somehow figure it out on your own. And that is rare. It really is rare that you were able to do that. And it's amazing. And obviously, it has served you very well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Caitlin, thank you so much for sharing your story and for talking to us and for going back into some of these memories and stuff. It's been really interesting, and I really, really appreciate it. It's always so fun for me to hear from people who have been in the program years ago and to hear a little bit more about what it was like, and also then to know that they're doing well. That's very rewarding for all of us.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Second Stories. If you enjoyed this episode, we would be so thankful if you rated our podcast and left us a review. Be sure to also hit subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Second Stories is created and produced by Second Story with support from our technical director, Franklin Vaughn. Second Story is a nonprofit based in Northern Virginia that works to provide safe havens and opportunities to grow and thrive to youth in crisis and their families. Learn more about what Second Story does and how you can support us at second-story.org. We hope you'll join us next time.